AmericansForTheArts.org.
Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. Filling in today, actually, Samar is out of the studio. And today we have a special guest that will be speaking to us, Lisa Vogel from Verona Collection. She's a founder of a clothing line. And in honor of Domestic Violence Month, we'll be speaking to her about her campaign to raise awareness about domestic violence. And also later in the program, we'll talk briefly about an update on what's happening in Turkey, all that and more when we come back. Welcome back to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed. I'm here in the studio with Lisa Vogel. She's the founder of a clothing line called the Verona Collection, a modest clothing line called Verona Collection. And she's joining us in the studio. We'll be talking about Domestic Violence Awareness Month and her campaign to raise awareness about domestic violence. But first, what's Verona Collection?
Of course. We are the first modest fashion brand to be bought and sold in an American department store.
So what is a modest clothing brand?
I mean, honestly, it can be your interpretation. So we try to offer just a variety of different clothing that's not so tight, a little bit, you know, loose, and kind of covers areas that, like, most other clothing don't. So
why are people interested in this?
Of course, it's worth about $500 billion.
It's a $500 billion
industry, correct.
People wanting to dress more modest.
Yes.
Is this for men and women, or just women?
I mean, well, if you want to get
your
into
clothing line.
Oh, my clothing line's just for women.
Oh, okay.
But modesty is not just for women.
So, yeah, of course. But why did you choose to start something like this?
I mean, there was just such a lack of, like, options, you know, like, not everybody wants to dress. And actually, like, Forever 21, I think, just went down. Not everybody wants, like, skimpy clothing, but for me, I'm a hijabi, so I'm Muslim, and I cover, and that's what I choose to do.
What's a hijabi?
It's a Muslim woman that adheres to the headscarf.
Yeah, hijab means headscarf.
Correct, yeah.
So you wear a headscarf.
Correct, yeah.
For those who are not watching us on the
WMNF. See me. I am covered from head to toe.
Okay, and why you do that?
Because I'm Muslim.
Making you do this?
Nobody.
Is there some man making you dress this way?
I am not married. My father did not make me do this. My brother did not make me do this. This is you. Yes, correct.
You chose to do this.
Correct, yes.
Okay. I mean, because, you know.
And actually, to be honest, I had a lot of adverse reactions. I was given a lot of, like, negativity for wearing it. You know, a lot of women in America are trying to put it on without getting harassed or Islamophobia. And so it's actually quite opposite. And you have places like France where they're trying to ban the headscarf, or I think they even banned the niqab. I don't want to misspeak, but I think that's what's happening. So women are even fighting to put it on.
Okay.
Everybody has something to say about what we wear, whether we want to take it off or put it on.
Are you against women wearing skimpy clothes?
No, of course not. I'm against anybody telling us what to wear, whether we want to take off the headscarf or put it on.
But I just see, like, there's so many people that are just obsessed with what women wear in general. But specifically, like, there seems to be a double standard in a way with Muslim women that want to dress modest or cover mm-hmm. up. There seems to be, like, this sense, especially, like, in the mainstream media or Western culture, that it is somehow backwards to dress that way.
Absolutely. I mean, they always use the word oppression. You know, I speak about this all the time in interviews, and oppression really comes down to being forced to do anything. And so, to me, women in Saudi Arabia or Iran, they're oppressed when they're forced to wear the headscarf. Women in France are being oppressed when they're forced to remove it. So anybody that can dictate what you choose to wear, whether it's covering or taking off, is a form of oppression, because liberation comes from freedom of choice.
So you're freely choosing to dress this way.
I am freely choosing.
But why?
Because
they have the thing here, like, you know, I mean, they always say, if, like, you've got it, but, like, they have... People just, I mean, but why? Why do you do it?
I mean, there's so many reasons. I mean, if you want to just get straight to the point, it's because the Quran says so, and that's, I choose to follow.
So before the Quran, were you dressing opposite?
I was actually always dressing a little bit more modestly. Like, I never really wore shorts that often. I chose to dress a little bit more modestly because I felt more comfortable like that.
Some people say, oh, well, you know, these people are insecure about who they are. That's why they dress that way.
No, it's because I don't want, and this isn't to say that people that are taking off that they're creating themselves to be sexual objects, but, you know, I think, you know, the woman's body, especially in Western society, has been objectified, and so I'm choosing what I want everybody else to see.
So if you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5. I'm speaking to Lisa Vogel. She's the founder of Verona Collection, a modest clothing line. She also happens to be Muslim. You can also, if you're near on your phone or on the computer, you can watch this live at Facebook, our Facebook page at WMNF News. I'm also sharing it, by the way, Blaney, on my own personal Facebook page, so people can also. Now, speaking of, you know, I said you're Muslim, but were you born Muslim?
I was not born Muslim. I was born a Christian. My father was Catholic. My mom came from a Baptist family, but she was not religious at all. She was very, like, spiritual, so she believed in just doing good things and good things come back to you. So, but my father was very much into organized religion.
What state where did you grow up
Michigan.
In? Michigan.
East
okay.
Lansing, Michigan.
Wow, all the way from Michigan to East Florida. Lansing, is that...
That's where Michigan State is.
Michigan State, are you a Michigan State fan?
Of course. Like, if you even bring, like, blue and yellow University of Michigan colors
the
in our home.
Is that the Wolverines?
Yeah, it is. You'll be, like, banned from our house.
Okay. So what kind of house did you grow up in?
What kind of house?
Yeah, I mean, is it, like...
I mean, to be very frank, like, we had, you know, I grew up with a very privileged upbringing. My father was an attorney, and my mom's an author. And she's also a speaker, what I hate to do.
And for those that are not, you know, that can't see you, you are, I guess, racially white.
Caucasian. Yes.
Caucasian.
White.
So you're from a privileged class of Michigan, high society, and...
I had a lot of privileges growing up, for sure.
You guys had money.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of people in Michigan that are poor.
We didn't always. Like, but the first part of my I actually, like, view money very differently because the first part of my life, mm-hmm. we actually didn't have a lot of money. And then everything changed when I hit 10 and I had experiences that people don't have their entire lifetime. So I'm very blessed, but, you know, when I look at money, I know we're going totally off topic, but I cherish the moments when we didn't have money because it was very family oriented and it was the simple things that we cherished.
So why would someone, from 10 years old on and then going to college and stuff, mm-hmm. You come from a background of privilege, a background of, you know, your parents are well off. Mm-hmm. Why would you join a religion and a culture that most people would think are, you know, very much or very different than what you were raised in?
It's actually not as different as you think it is. Like, you know, I always, and I still do, believe in Jesus, peace be upon him. And I didn't have to give that up becoming Muslim. Really, the main core difference of Islam versus Christianity is the role of Jesus. And my belief is that Jesus, God is powerful enough to create you. Therefore, he doesn't need to sacrifice anything to forgive you. And so that's really the bottom line of what it came down to. But then there was also a lot of answers that were, or a lot of questions that were answered for me. And I always question, well, what if children aren't given the Bible? Do they go straight to hell? And Islam answers that. And so children go straight to heaven in Islam, you know? Or what about the idea of if they never heard of Islam, do they go straight to hell? You know, and you're judged based on what you know. And so that's what, and if you openly and you know it's the truth and then choose to reject it, that's when you're.
When was your first, I guess, memory of Islam?
My first memory of Islam was in, and this is the first time I ever even knew, I'm like, what's a Muslim, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I know it's like out in the open, it's in the news 24/7, but I'm 37 years old. So it's like, it wasn't this like well spoken about topic that we heard about so often. It was a classmate. We were discussing, should we have a prayer area in our school, and I was in seventh grade.
In seventh grade?
Yeah.
Why were they discussing this?
I don't know. It's just, I think they wanted to get us to more, like, you know, a more Q&A type of environment.
Is it allowed or something?
Yes, and we were just having a debate, like, should we have this in our school?
And then what happened?
And a Muslim spoke up, and he said, well, here's what I need, you know, explaining his religion and how you can't walk in front of people when you pray. And I'm like, what religion is he? You know, because pretty much what I grew around was just Christianity.
So that was the first time you heard of a Muslim.
It was the first time I heard.
Seventh grade.
Yes. Like, you would think that's so late in life to be introduced to it, but that's the reality.
Okay.
And then I had like a few Muslim friends in high school. So very few, I could say maybe 3 to 4 that I even knew of. And I still didn't know much about it.
I mean, Michigan has a lot of Muslims, but they're mainly in Detroit.
But we're East Lansing. Yeah. I didn't even know of Dearborn at the time.
Okay.
So now people, when they see me, they're like, think I'm Arab. You know, I can pass for an Arab. of the way I look. And they're like, oh, are you from Dearborn? And I'm like, nope.
Not you mean the way you look, the way you dress?
The way both. I mean, Arab people come up to me and start speaking Arabic to me. So.
Okay. And then, yeah. So, but when did you actually start considering?
So my first true introduction to Islam was, I think, freshman or sophomore in college. And I had a lot of, like, Muslim friends, and they really introduced me to Islam. Mm. So then I just got interested in learning a little bit. But then I'm kind of like a gypsy spirit. And I saved up. I took a semester off of college. I saved up all my money. And I went and lived in Morocco for 3 months.
Morocco?
Yes.
Okay. To learn about Islam or for something
else?
No,
it was just to have a cultural experience, not a religious one. Okay. So I went and I lived with a Moroccan family, and I taught English at the American Language Center in Tanger, Morocco.
That's like on the north coast of Morocco.
It's at the very tip point of Africa.
North Africa. You can see Spain.
It's 9 miles away. Yes, yes. I just want to say that you can see
Spain.
How
far is Spain?
9 miles.
That's it.
Yes.
Okay.
But
is that like, I guess if you're at the tip of Tampa and then you're looking at
it's like the bay to like, basically, on a clear day, you can probably see it. And I remember to this day, I was 19 years old and I took a boat from Spain to Africa. And I just remember seeing a completely, because we had traveled, but it was like Paris and Germany and like, you know, very...
Where white people go, you know, Paris,
where
Berlin,
my mom's thinking we're cultured because
Frankfurt,
we're going to... Yeah, exactly.
Zurich.
Exactly, Switzerland.
Venice and Rome.
England.
Okay.
You know, so I've been
so then you decided to go to...
Morocco, and it was completely different from everything I've ever experienced. And it wasn't like I went and got a hotel, a 5-star hotel, and you still have all the luxuries. No, I lived, this is my friend in college, he set this up. I lived with a family that lived right in the Medina, which is what
the
is
old
it?
City.
Exactly. No hot water.
No hot water.
No
wow.
toilet.
What? No toilet?
No toilet. I mean, like you had to flush, like you had to put a bucket to flush it, basically.
Okay.
Like every possible like luxury that we take for granted here, it was taken away from me.
Yeah, I didn't think flushing a toilet is a privilege, but I guess it is.
When
many places don't have, you
when
know,
you're
these.
When you have all of that taken away, you're like, wow, this is definitely.
And you didn't run away.
I did not run away. I embraced it, and I was so
thankful.
But
let's just make that clear. It's not Muslim culture to have. This is just like a.
This is a third world, you know.
A poor country.
Yeah,
or
and
poor
there, you know, there's a lot of places in Morocco that are very, like, you know.
You just, you went to a very traditional family.
Yeah.
You live with them for how long?
3 months.
Okay, but did you, is that why you converted?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
No. I like, appreciated, like, the experience, and I actually wore the abaya and the hijab when I was there, but it had no religious meaning at all. It was just for respect of
their culture.
Exactly.
Okay.
So. And what I have to make clear is the hijab is not culture. I know we keep throwing that word around, but I was doing it for the cultural norm, but the hijab in itself is not a cultural.
You discovered that later.
Later, yeah.
Okay, so just because we want to talk about the other topic, when did you actually, or what was it that got you to convert or
so then
to consider
I went on,
the religion?
I came back and I graduated college. I went to an all-girls school, Chatham University in Pittsburgh, went on and worked in the corporate world, and then I moved to Florida. And
you found Islam in Florida?
I did, yeah, out of all places.
The bastion,
like
the bastion of Islam. You didn't
go
to
Mecca. We
have
the most hate crimes in this state, and I've been subject to it myself.
And out of all places, you're choosing to dress modest in Florida, like the sunny state.
I know. But when I believe in something, I have conviction in it, whatever it takes, I'm going to do.
Okay, so you found it in Florida.
In photography school over a photography project.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Because I have a degree in photography, and that's actually how I ended up getting into the fashion industry. And
so you left the corporate world.
I left the corporate world, and I was like, I need to do what I love.
To pursue something, and you love photography.
Yeah.
So
now
you,
I'm like, please don't hire me. I'm so burnt out.
Okay, but no,
like,
back then.
Yeah. So then I was given an assignment in, we were, you know, doing an editing I was in an editing class for video, and this topic was open what we wanted to cover. So I decided to research why women wear the hijab, because I had worn it myself, but I didn't have the meaning behind it. I wanted to discover the true meaning.
Hmm. Okay. And your research led you to something.
And I interviewed a lot of Muslims in Orlando, and, you know, I was asking very ignorant questions that I get asked now, you know, even like, are you hot in that? You know,
and yeah,
I mean, of course I'm hot. I'm covered from head to toe, but it's like,
I mean, even if you're
everyone's hot.
Everyone is hot because just the heat.
Exactly. Like everyone's hot.
Yeah. But it
was the first time I discovered that hijab is in the Bible. I had been Christian my whole life. I'd gone to Young Life camp. I went to Bible study. I was at church every Sunday practically. And I never knew the hijab was in the Bible. It's in Corinthians chapter 11, verse 6.
Corinthians chapter 11, verse 6?
Yes.
It says the word hijab.
The head covering. And the way it is actually, and I don't want to misquote, but the way it's actually said is kind of derogatory towards women. It says that if you don't wear it, you should shave your head out of shame. So I feel that.
You know, I mean, what's interesting is because I've gone to some, you know, churches. Like I went to churches in Italy before.
And they're covered.
And they won't let you in, tourist in, unless you cover your hair.
Yeah.
Because that's just their customs. And I talked to people, you know, 50 years ago, 30 years ago, even in the United States, it was a tradition to wear a scarf when you go to church, especially Catholic churches. So it's not that, I guess people
just
forget.
I think it's that in America, we're just brainwashed to think that this is an oppressive way of thinking. You know, it's just because it's different. Just because it's different doesn't make it oppressive.
I always feel like it's a way to just demonize Muslims, to kind of just show that they're different and that somehow they're backwards and, you know, they lack freedom.
I think now, but I don't think that growing up, there wasn't, this is pre-9/11.
The Islamophobia, I wasn't as
No, but I remember hearing comments about women covering that it's like, oh, I feel so bad for those women. And it comes from a loving place. You know, sometimes we don't always like the quote unquote, like, judgments don't always come from a hate, you know, a hatred.
It's out of concern.
It's out of like they legitimately think
that these women need
are
help.
Being forced.
But to be honest, some of these women are forced,
of course, in some
of these societies, like you mentioned, Iran and Saudi Arabia. Even though Saudi Arabia is loosening up some of
in
these
in some parts, it depends on where you are.
Yeah, and like you know, now women are allowed to drive finally, but of course, they have other problems with other freedoms like freedom of speech, not just for women, but for men and women, for anybody. However, how did you, I guess, separate, you know, the cultural practices that may be practice or, you know,
because I have a mind of my own.
Differentiate that from the religious
because
practice.
that's not what the religion teaches. I can't follow Muslims, I follow Islam.
Okay.
Just like you don't follow Christians, you follow Christianity. You know, like Jesus taught, love thy neighbor. That's not what everybody's doing, right? So it's about following the religion and not Muslims. And that's not to say that Muslims aren't great people. Like there's a majority of Muslims I meet are amazing. They donate more than anybody to charity. They're like, you know, so, but it comes down to following the religion, not the people.
Okay. When did you, what year was this when you converted?
It was July 29th, 2011.
July 29th, 2011.
Yeah. My life changed.
That's when your life changed. It was 8 years ago. And then since then, you basically not only joined the religion, you're wearing a headscarf.
I actually wore the headscarf before I converted.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because I knew I wanted to convert. So I started, I should say part-time. Like I would actually, I was like waitressing during college.
But in 2011, you know, this is kind of the height of Islamophobia.
And I received it.
And, you know, it's not like something that most people want to jump into to join, especially coming from a privileged background to a community or a class of people that are despised.
I didn't see it like that. Like,
I mean, there is research that, you know, there's Islamophobia and hate of Muslims in this country.
There is. And the first time I received hate was the first time I truly understood. I recognized white privilege and I knew it was there, but it was the first time I understood it because someone saw me as other.
What happened?
I was on a photography assignment and I pulled off to the road because I wanted to see like a shot that I wanted to do. And this woman started coming up screaming at me to go back home. And my jaw dropped because I had no words for her. I was with a brown classmate. Mm-hmm. She was screaming at both of us. And
this is in Orlando.
It was in Sanford, which is just outside of Orlando.
Yeah.
And
the same town where Trayvon Martin was killed.
I lived literally behind, like right behind his block.
You did?
I did. I literally lived like within walking distance from that incident. But that time that I received hate, it was the first time that I truly understood what African Americans go through, what people of color go through, how...
Not maybe to the extent, of course. Nobody was, like, beating you on the street.
No, we had to call the police.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because it ended up being that she was going after some other, he was, you know, a brown man. I think he was maybe Indian, just by guessing. He was getting in her face, and then my jaw dropped witnessing it, and then she started coming after me and my classmate. Mm. I think she was drunk. That's just a guess. I don't know, but we had to call... multiple people had to call the police on her, and the cops did nothing. We had her, license plate. We knew who she
was.
What
could they do? I mean, in a way, like, I guess cops can't, unless she got violent, they can't really do much.
Probably,
if she's just using, you know, derogatory language. Okay. You joined the religion. You not only did that, you wore the scarf, but then you, really immersed yourself, and mm-hmm. now you have a clothing brand.
Yes, correct.
Modest clothing, and you know you're running a company that actually now has influence within, I guess, not only the Muslim community but the wider. Where can people find your product, this Verona collection? Where do they buy it?
It's on Macy's.com.
Okay.
ASOS. We just signed a deal with ASOS, and then Verona-Collection.com is our website. So it can buy directly from us or with Macy's or with ASOS.
And, okay, now the topic of today, the reason, you know, we're having you on is because it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And, you know, I noticed that you had your own campaign about domestic violence.
I'm very outspoken about this.
Yeah, why?
Because I'm a victim of domestic violence, a survivor.
Who, by at the hands of your abused
ex-husband.
Your ex-husband abused
mm-hmm.
you?
Yeah.
Sure this is difficult to talk about.
I mean, yeah, and maybe in this episode with us speaking about it, I could start crying. But I speak a lot about it, and sometimes I'm very almost robotic about the topic because, you know, I talk to other women who have been through abuse, and it can be so, like, normalized when we talk about it, which is not okay that we're quote unquote normalizing it, but it's almost our way of survival and our way of, like, being able to function with the pain that we hold inside of us.
Why do you choose to talk about it?
Because it's a topic that is swept under the rug, and we're taught that victims or survivors should feel shame. The one that should feel shame is the perpetrator. I should not feel ashamed that a man and I want to be clear, women are abusers too. Like, 1 in 7 men are abused. Just as
but the overwhelming majority.
It's majority women, of course. You know, we're taught to feel the shame on it. You know, and so that's why, if we don't speak out about it, nothing's going to change. You're talking about 25% of this country of women have been abused. That's a problem, and we're not talking about it enough. I was very hesitant to talk about this. Why? Because I'm a white woman who chose to convert to Islam, and then I was abused by a Muslim man. I didn't want to reiterate a stereotype.
So the religion you joined, somebody that was practicing that you chose to marry was also abused you. I mean, someone might blame the religion.
They're going to, of course, but that's just a cop-out because statistics show that 1 in 4 women in America have been abused. They're not all Muslims. They're a small percentage of Muslims in that statistic.
So
this is not...
It happens in all religions.
I get messages from women day in and day out, and I promise you, some are Muslim, some are Christian, some are white, some are black, some are Hispanic. Abuse does not have any discrimination with, you know, whether you're come from a well-off family, whether you're coming from a less wealthy family, or you have a lot of education, or you're not as educated. Like, there is no discrimination when it comes to abuse. It happens to everybody. I am a college-educated woman, came from a very good background, and I found myself in a women's shelter. It could happen to anybody.
And how long before you, I mean, how long were you in this situation?
I was I got married in 2013.
2 years after you converted?
Yes, yeah. So there's no man a part of me, you know, converting, but then I've, you know, it's obviously it's, you know, recommended in Islam, which you know very well, that, you know, to get married, you know, and you don't date that often. You just kind of, you know, you really, when you're talking to a man, you're talking to him for the purpose of
marriage. How'd you find this person?
We met on a Muslim dating site.
There are Muslim dating sites.
Well, marriage sites, I should say. I don't want to get...
Okay.
Dating's haram. Not lawful.
Haram means like forbidden?
Yeah, yeah. You're just
how are you supposed to meet people? How are you supposed to...
I mean, you're talking for the... I prefer it versus the old, you know, way of quote-unquote dating beforehand. You just cut right to the chase. You're like, listen, don't waste my time. What are you looking for?
Uh-huh.
And so it's normal. That's how
but you... How do you know you're compatible and stuff?
That's the point. You're meeting for the purpose of compatibility. You find out, you know, what do you want out of life? How do you want kids? What do you feel about me working and you staying at home? Vice versa. You get right to the chase.
Okay, but you thought you got the right person.
I did, but looking back, now I understand all the red flags. So when I...
There were red flags and you ignored them.
Exactly, yeah.
I think a lot of people do that.
I don't know if it's that I ignored them. It's just that I didn't understand.
Do they
that.
Say love is blind? Sometimes people are blinded when they're in exciting, like new relationships are exciting.
Yes and no, but I think looking back, there were clear red signs. You know, it's not like people think that it's like the one question they always ask is, why didn't she just leave?
Yeah.
It doesn't, one, don't ask that. Anyone who's listening, don't ever ask that again. It's not... If abusive relationships just start and all of a sudden, boom, he hits me the day we meet, you're going to walk away. You're going to think the man's crazy. That's not how abuse works.
It creeps in.
They start off really small. Mm-hmm. And there's emotional abuse at first. And I want to be clear, we're always so vocal about physical abuse. I can tell you, someone who's been hospitalized twice, emotional abuse is way worse. Way worse.
What are examples of emotional abuse?
So abuse is two things and two things only, power and control. And that's it. And they want to just control you. They want to control you, whether it's financially, whether it's hanging out with certain friends, where you can go certain places, you know, how you dress, how you need to look. It's demonizing you. It's telling you you're not good enough. This man, when he hit me to the ground, it wasn't the, when he hit me to the ground and he said, I can marry anybody. And he said, I make $1 million. And then he called me a bad word. It's the demonizing things that they say and they put you down. And it's bit by bit by bit by bit by bit until they take all your strength away and you have nothing left in you to fight back. And it becomes a cycle. They typically abuse you. They go to a remorseful stage. And then it goes back to the honeymoon stage. My ex would buy me, like, he was the cheapest man in the world. He wouldn't allow me to buy Starbucks.
Was he poor?
No, he made $180,000 a year working as a physician assistant in an emergency room. But yet he buys me a $5,000 ring just randomly one day. And it was like his quote unquote apology to me. They would do these like crazy purchases, but then you weren't allowed to buy for yourself. It all came down to power and control.
Well, can somebody who, I mean, a person who's abusive, do they love the person? Can they actually, are they capable of loving?
I typically think it's certainly not a true love.
Mm.
A true love, does not control you. It's not, you know, they're going to trust you. They're going to let you be who you are. This man didn't let me be who I was. I lost myself. I didn't even know who I was anymore when I was in the marriage. I completely lost myself.
How long after you were married did you first receive abuse? Or were you a recipient
Looking
of abuse?
Back, yeah. I didn't understand it was abuse. Mm-hmm. It started within a couple. Actually, I want to say the first week. I went out, I think, to meet a friend. I came back and he had thrown half of my clothes away. He gave them away. I had all of these Indian and Pakistani clothes that I had like purchased for weddings.
Yeah.
That because I have obviously now that I'm in the Muslim community, I have a lot of Pakistani friends. And so it's nice to wear Pakistani clothes when you go to the weddings and they're not cheap. It was probably worth $1,500.
They're like, yeah, fancy. They have sequins.
He goes, I don't want you. And he's Pakistani.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, I don't want you wearing Pakistani clothes. And he had given them all away just like that.
Okay, yeah, that's...
And so looking, and I'm already married. At that point, I didn't know I was pregnant, but we got pregnant like right away. And you're obviously not just going to up and divorce a person over one major thing immediately, right? So I got upset, but I didn't scream or yell. I was sad and I was upset about it. And he just said, no, I don't want you wearing that. Looking back, I see how much of a red flag that was. And
when was the first physical abuse?
First physical abuse didn't start until, and so I got pregnant, like I said, right away. I got married in March, pregnant right away, had a baby December 31st, 2013. And then it was 2 months after that was the first time he hit me.
2 months?
2 months after the birth of my first child, yeah. So it was about a year and just a little less than a year, actually, yeah, into the marriage.
And then from that point until you left, how long was it?
I didn't leave. I left October 2015, and I came to Florida.
So almost 2 years later.
Yeah, we were living in Dallas, and I waited till he went to work. And I think everyone who's gone through abuse, they remember the first time that they were abused, and they remember the last time. And I remember that I had finally had it. I had finally had it. I did not have a plan. I didn't know what I was going to do. I called, my really good friend, Russia. She was the first call I made. And I was calling her in tears, telling her what was happening. She goes, oh my God, give me just a minute. Let me call some people. She called, some friends of ours, Arthur. He worked for a charity organization, but I was very good friends with him. He calls me and goes, get in the car, get the kids and come. Don't think about anything. Just leave. So he went to work. My business partner, Alat, she bought me baby diapers, wipes, baby food.
You didn't have anything to buy that stuff.
I had nothing because he controlled everything.
But you had just started a business.
It was brand new.
Like how many months?
Like 3-4 months.
So you actually, while you're going through this abuse, you also decided to start this clothing brand.
Mm-hmm. I had just started it.
And so it's amazing to think like, okay, you're starting a new company. It takes a lot of time, dedication, focus. But at the same time, you're going through this a horrific situation at home.
Yeah. And, looking at Verona, I look at it and I'm like, it gave me a positive outlet. But it also, I looked at my kids and I was like, I have to make it. I was broken inside, but it was also my positive outlet as well. I needed something positive in my life to work on. And that's what Verona is not just about empowering other women and, being confident and choosing how you want to dress. It gave me a positive outlet to work towards and know that I have to make it for my children.
So there was certain, I guess, to give you a sense of hope or there's something to, but you also couldn't fail.
Exactly.
You had a lot of riding on this.
I did.
So you had to make it work.
And he didn't, we didn't up and divorce right away. When I came to Florida, he knew, and just like every other victim and survivor, I left and came back multiple times. I think there's a statistic that said victims of domestic violence leave 11 times and come back before they leave for good. And that's if they are able to.
What made you come back?
No, I didn't go back.
You mean
every time?
Yeah.
They break you down and they brainwash you mentally so much. It's also financial control. Like I had given up my photography business. I had two kids to take care of. My child at the time when I actually left was 5 months and a year old. I gotten pregnant a third time and I miscarried because he was beating me during the pregnancy. But it's like,
why? I mean, okay. If this is a very personal question.
Mm-hmm.
If there was abuse and he punched you, and I don't know if it's appropriate to even ask, why were you having
that's
children?
That's the thing. There's a mentality that occurs when you're in an abusive relationship. You start to feel like you need them.
Mm.
I would be running after asking for him to apologize, forgive me.
Like you were the one,
one that was like,
it was your fault.
It was my fault. I felt like I needed him, whether it be financially, emotionally. It doesn't make any sense from someone who is in a good place, but that's the mentality I had, and I know a lot of other victims have, that you feel like you can't live without your abuser.
Yeah, somebody asked, we need to hear the ex's side of the story, but the because what? We're not mentioning the ex's, no, somebody had posted a comment on our live feed that, well, shouldn't we be hearing both sides of this story? But the reality is we're not mentioning anyone's name.
Be honest, it could honestly be him. He literally watches me every move.
Oh, okay.
Like, very honest. Yeah. I would say you would like to hear his reasoning for strangling me. That should tell you something about your mentality.
Hmm. But, you know, this is not to say, because again, we're not mentioning the person's name.
I am not here for revenge for this man.
Yeah,
I've never mentioned his
name. I guess the goal of the show of doing this is to raise awareness about domestic violence and having somebody who's gone through it and to kind of share with others, especially that are going through it right now. You know, what advice do you have for them? What can they do? Because oftentimes, you know, I've talked to a couple of people before that sought help or were looking, and then you give them the help and actually even try to help set them up to get away or get out. But then you get disappointed later because they go back to the same situation. And then you're like, well, why do you keep going back? But again, it's very difficult because
it's very difficult to break out of the mentality to leave. Like,
there's a lot of, I guess, fear and then the dependence on that person.
They put fear in you. Women are most in danger when they are trying to leave.
Mm.
I remember, and the same thing, he had his first wife that he was abusive to. She tried calling 911 on him and he smacked the phone out of her hand. You know, when I tried calling 911, he broke the door down. He pulled my hair. Put me on, and I'm going back to that question of that person asking, and I'm just thinking, I just can't get that out of my head. I'm sorry.
Which question?
I have to address that. I want someone to comment back and say, give me a valid reason why a man can strangle a woman.
It's never acceptable, obviously.
They should comment back on their side and then ask, I would like to hear what the side is, what the justification is for touching a woman. And I say to this person, there is no excuse for abuse. And if you feel justified to hear the other side, you should really check your mentality.
Yeah.
So really check your mentality. And it could even, to be honest, it could even be a woman. In this process, I found that misogyny is not, it's not about coming from a man. It's a mentality. And again, this obviously doesn't just happen to women. 1 in 7 men are abused.
What advice do you have for women that are going through this?
I think that, one, they're never going to change. And you have to understand that. I would love to say, I believe in people, you know, because I have that mentality of, like, I believe people can change. But if they're a narcissist, they're not going to change. And that's just the reality of it. We have this hope. I would pray and pray and pray, please change, please change. Please, God, please guide him, you know. Get us help. I took him to multiple counselors and imams, which is the religious leader in the mosque, and they never change. So you have to find a plan to get out, but you have to be smart about it. Unfortunately, I didn't have a plan because I always had the mentality he's going to change. So I had to up and leave, and it was very hard to get things, you know, to started in my life. He did not cut off the money for the year. And I'm very honest. Like, I will tell, oh yeah, this is, no, he did this part. You know what I mean? I agree. I told him, I said, I'm going to give you 1 year to change. You get help, but you provide for me and the boys. And if you change, I'll stay married to you. If you don't, I'm going to divorce you. He did provide. Mm-hmm. But the minute I said, you're not going to change, I have to divorce you. Of course, like expected, every single penny was cut off. And he helped bits and pieces, you know, here and there, but it would be me begging him. So I would say have a plan.
Have a plan. What advice do you have for men who, I guess,
I would say I think with men, and I do hear from abused
men. Not men that are abused. I meant men who know of a situation where there is abuse. Maybe it's their friend that's abusing, or so-called friend that's abusing a woman.
Everyone thinks it's none of their business. It is. I now believe that if you are witnessing oppression and you do nothing, you are just as bad. That's what I believe. Because there were very few people that knew about the abuse, and it was the people that did know were his family. Some of his family members were like, you need to leave. And that takes a lot from a family that is quite cultural. They were like, you need to leave. But there were also, they also normalized it. They're like, well, you know, and this is where I am more spoken out about the Muslim community, that I would say that the Muslim community has got to step it up big time versus mm-hmm. like, and there's no more abuse in the Muslim community or not, but this is where they need to step it up, where they're like, just be patient, read Quran, you know, he can change. No, if a man is hitting a woman, it needs to be taken seriously. And they need to step in and they need to help her.
Immediate action.
Yes, immediate. Because the reality is I was the perfect quote unquote victim for him. My father had passed away. My brother is young. I didn't have anybody to step in. They, a lot of times abusers seek quote unquote vulnerable women. They're like, they prey on us. And so they need somebody to come in and help them. They have taken away every bit of your strength.
I asked you earlier, because the abuse is coming from a Muslim guy or claims to be Muslim, or, you know, he's abusive and he is Muslim and you converted to this faith. Did that ever cause you to doubt the religion?
Not at all. I got closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, God.
Because of this, you got closer to God.
Yeah.
Did the religion or your faith in Islam, did that help you get through this?
It's everything. It's what got me through it. Mm. It's literally Islam and my relationship with God is what got me through it.
Okay, well, if you just joined us, we're almost at the end of our program. I've been speaking to Lisa Vogel,
who has known me for a decade, yeah. And he forgot my name.
No, I just blanked out because the conversation is so
it's intense,
and you know, because I do know you,
yeah.
I
remember the first time we saw each other, mm-hmm. like, and we ran each other to the mosque. It was the first time we've seen each other
in a long
since
time.
I had spoken out,
right?
And
yeah, so I mean, I didn't know those things were happening.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's just kind of it's you know. So Lisa is a founder of a modest clothing line called Verona Collection, and she's a convert to Islam. And we've been speaking about domestic violence because it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. If you're in a situation like that, Lisa is advising that get a plan and get out, because people like that will never change. And you know,
and if they do, and I pray they do, you should not be subject to the abuse while they try to change. You should not. You're not a punching bag. So people need to understand that. If they want to give people the opportunity to change, let them. Not while you're being beaten up or abused.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Lisa, for joining us.
Thank you.
I just want to shift gears now, especially for people that are watching us. And Blaney, you can, I guess, focus more on me, because I'm going to say goodbye to Lisa. But hope to have you more on in the future. And they can find more about your clothing line where?
Verona Collection is our Instagram and Facebook. And then my Instagram is Lisa M. Vogel, V-O-G-L.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa, for joining us. And now I just want to just bring people up to speed on what's been happening in northern Syria with Turkey's incursion or military action in the north of Syria. You know, since last week, there's been a lot of outrage, bipartisan outrage, anger over what's being depicted as the betrayal of our Kurdish allies in North Syria. And, you know, even to the point that people like Benjamin Netanyahu has been outspoken, you know, the leader or the prime minister of Israel, who his country has been occupying Palestinians for decades, speaking out in favor of the Kurdish allies of the United States. But I think what a lot of the media out there is ignoring is that this was a short-term arrangement with a group called the Syrian Democratic Forces, who are really part of these Kurdish militias called the YPG and the PKK, who the United States considers, the PKK specifically, as a terrorist organization, and so does the European Union. When the Obama administration was looking for a way to fight ISIS in Syria, they were looking for which partners. They didn't want to dedicate foot soldiers on the ground, and they were looking for who will actually do the fighting on the ground. And there were many options, including something called the Free Syrian Army, which were Syrians that defected from the Bashar al-Assad regime and now were fighting as rebels in part of a revolution to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. At the same time, the Obama administration was trying to come up with what's called the Iran nuclear deal. Iran was vested in protecting Bashar al-Assad, and they had already sent fighters from Iran and from Iraq and other parts, and Hezbollah, their allies Hezbollah, to go fight and defend Bashar al-Assad. So the Obama administration was reluctant to support the Free Syrian Army because that would anger the, because they were enemies of Iran and Hezbollah, that would anger Iran. They didn't want to destabilize that deal, and they were, that was a priority for the Obama administration. So because of that deal, they chose to find a group in Turkey or in Syria that others did not have a problem with. The only people that had a problem with this group were the Turks, because the PKK, which is considered again by the United States as a terrorist organization, has been responsible for the death of some 30 to 40,000 Turkish citizens. So obviously they see it as a problem. And last week I had played a video of U.S. Commander Raymond Thomas saying how overnight they changed their name from the YPG and the PKK to the Syrian Democratic Forces. So now that Trump had pulled out the troops there to make way for Turkey to go in, everyone saw it as a betrayal of the Kurds who fought along against ISIS. But these Kurdish militias knew what they were getting into. They knew this arrangement would be short-term and not long-lived. And it was a matter of time for it to come to an end. These YPG fighters who have been looking to have their own state for a long time and have not been successful, saw this as an opportunity to gain more land, the land that was being pushed, you know, they were taken over from ISIS as ISIS was getting defeated. The Kurdish militias were taking them over, and these lands did not belong to Kurdish populations. They were, the people that lived there are Syrian Arabs. So there was that fled, many of them, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, had fled into Turkey because of the fighting. Turkey is holding some 4 million refugees there, and others are displaced around the world. So these people have a right to go back to their places. And, I'm glad that there's a ceasefire now, which is allowing the YPG to actually pull their forces back. Because that was a condition that Turkey had set. But I just thought that there was some sort of double standard and a hypocrisy happening, because the same people that had been outraged, whether in the media or politicians, for 5 days, for like less than a week of this campaign, they've been silent for some 7 years as Bashar al-Assad, Iran, and Russia have been bombing and killing hundreds of thousands of Syrians. So people in the Middle East are not going to take this outrage. They're calling it faux outrage. They're not going to take it seriously because the United States enabled or somehow made this, their inaction has made it possible for all these massacres to take place over the past 7 years, and especially the United States' participation in the war in Yemen and providing arms to the Saudis and the UAE to continue the massacre of Yemenis there. So these inconsistent policies send the wrong message to people in that part of the world, that, you know, they're not taking it seriously. So those are my comments. NPR News is now. Have a good weekend. True Talk, WMF Tampa. NPR News is next.